The following is a production of University Laboratory High School and Illinois Public Media.
Men and women from Central Illinois have served in the U.S. military since the early 19th century. We remember their lives and service on national holidays or in wartime, but we rarely get an in-depth, historical view of military service from the perspectives of service personnel and their families. University Laboratory High School students interviewed several U.S. military personnel and their family members about their experiences from World War II to the present. The stories of these 12 men and 6 women, who come from very different backgrounds, give us an inside view of the military as it changed over time. We proudly present their stories in From the Frontlines to the Home Front. I'm Sanjay Koshy.
And I'm Leif Haig.
I was actually not old enough to join the Marine Corps on my own. I was 17 years old when I graduated from high school. But I bucked my mom pretty good until she realized that I wouldn't have it any other way. I don't know if she really understood why I was graduating from high school. I didn't have any skills. I didn't have extended family. I wanted to prove myself. I wanted to become a man, a decent man.
It's a beautiful concept that we have these ideas that we can all express and that we can all choose to have a religion or not believe in God, and that's a good thing. And I love that. I believed in it, and I thought the United States has helped me become the person I am. I can practice Islam in any way I see fit. I can do whatever I want. I'm a woman and I can fix cars, I can drive, I can read, I can get a college education, and nowhere in this country is that against the law. I wanted to, what I call, pay my debt. This country has given me a lot and I wanted to give back.
I don't think you'll ever have a relationship with anybody like you have with the person next to you in a combat situation, because your emotions are tied to helping this person do their job, and at the same time you're doing your job. You have a great love for the people that you're with, and you will do absolutely anything to help them. It's just something that you'll never leave you.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo.
In 1941, following surprise attacks by the Japanese military on American forces in Pearl Harbor, the United States entered the Second World War. It was a moment that many would remember for decades.
When Pearl Harbor came along, I was at the movie, and all of a sudden they shut down the movie and everybody returned to the barracks. They didn't say why or nothing, but once you got outside, you knew something was going on, and we didn't know the war was on, you know, that the Japanese had hit Pearl Harbor. And by the time we got back to the barracks, why, they were loading up the trucks and everything.
Though the U.S. government had already implemented a draft in response to German expansion in Europe, the number of draftees rose sharply after the Pearl Harbor attack. Over the next 3.5 years, 16 million men served in the military, 10 million of whom were draftees. Women were not drafted, but some did serve in the military, while others joined organizations like the Red Cross.
My twin brother Jack was in the Army. My brother Bob was in the Navy. Every young man I knew was in the service, and everybody was 100% backing the United States in the World War II effort. So I wanted to be more active than my civil service job in Decatur, and I volunteered and went to Washington, D.C. in November 43 for a 2-week course with the Red Cross. First week was history and functions of the Red Cross and all its divisions, and the second week our specific job functions. I volunteered for Clubmobile, which was a request of Eisenhower. He wanted a mobile service to get out to the combat troops. It started out in England using the English Green Line buses. They were equipped with donut machines. Donuts, incidentally, is the second most popular food that the GIs and service people wanted. First was hamburgers and then donuts next. We also had a phonograph on the Clubmobile with 78 RPM records in a PA system. And the minute we'd come up to some place to serve, we'd turn on the music. The guys just came from every place. And we danced to the records and served hot coffee and donuts. The GIs loved our service. We loved it because it was wanted and desired. And we went out to the combat troops and served them.
Some military women served in the medical corps, and a few became pilots, though most were assigned clerical jobs.
Well, certainly they got the same pay and the same rank structure and all that. In World War II, women were enlisted primarily to free up males to fight in combat roles. So the women did not participate in combat roles. It was simply an emergency measure to free up men so that they could participate in combat roles. As a matter of fact, the women in the Navy were called WAVES, W-A-V-E-S, Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service. So I think the thought process at the time was this is a temporary thing, and as soon as the war is over, we'll release all the women and go back to the way it was.
During the Second World War, American military units were still segregated by race. One of the first African Americans to serve in the Marines recalls how the reality of military service turned out to be quite different from the promises of his recruiter.
He said, well, if you join the Marines, you'll receive the same training that all of the other Marines receive. I said, really? He said, yes. I was too naive to ask other questions about would I be in the same camp, same companies, and all of that sort of thing. If I receive the same training, it must be in the same camp. Well, I just assumed that it would be if it were the same. My sameness wasn't the same as his, I discovered. It wasn't the training as such. It was the fact that it was separate from the main body of Marines, and I always felt that it was something second class about it, and I didn't think that since I had given up my civilian life, which was rather first class as I understood it at that time, to go into the Marines to serve my country with a second class status. That's a demotion, so to speak. It didn't make sense. I didn't understand why my country would want to do that to me.
Racism in the military was a reflection of the conditions and attitudes toward black people in the United States, especially in the Jim Crow South.
We were going through a place in Mississippi. The train stopped at, I think it was Tupelo, and there was a big sign, "Welcome, servicemen." The Red Cross was there with donuts, mountains of donuts and coffee urns. And we were like, oh boy, this is fine. We were going to be treated to coffee and donuts. We waited and waited and nothing happened. We expected our officers to tell us to fall out and go up the hill and get donuts and coffee. Nothing happened. Finally, a man came down the hill and walked along the track, sauntering and looking in. He didn't see anything but black faces. I think our white officers were hiding. I don't know where they were. The man went back up the hill and apparently told the women that only black Marines were on the train. Or only black. I don't know if he knew whether we were Marines or what. He just knew we were servicemen. And they closed down. Close the shop down. First, I was so angry with the American Red Cross for bending to the mores of the South in that way. After that, and forever after, I was angry with our officers for not saying, these are my men, they're servicemen, they're entitled to coffee and donuts at least. But they didn't do that. I didn't have much confidence or feel too kindly towards officers who were going to take me overseas and couldn't even face customs of the South. They didn't have the courage to do that.
Many wartime experiences left lasting memories. During the final months of World War II, the full horrors of the Holocaust came to light. As Allied troops penetrated deeper into German territory, they found Nazi concentration and extermination camps. These camps were used to confine and kill millions of people deemed undesirable, including Jews, Roma, homosexuals, and people with disabilities.
First one we came across, Ohrdruf, was in April. We were there the day after it was liberated, and there were still bodies that hadn't been taken care of. We also went to Buchenwald, which was near Weimar, the day after it was liberated, and there were bodies in the crematorium, some slave laborers, just like skin and bones there. And I did see the lamp shade that the commandant's wife had made from the skin of the prisoners. We saw the gas rooms, which were underground, and the commandant, he'd just walk over the top, and there was a little air hole, or he'd put the gas pellets down there and kill hundreds of people in these big rooms. They were told to strip, take all their clothes off, and put shoes here and stuff here and stuff here, that they were going to be deloused. That's what they were told. So here are all these men, women, and some children, all naked in these big, big rooms. They closed the doors, and then the commandant up above would walk along and just drop the cyanide tablets in there. And, of course, all these people just killed. Some of them put in mass graves, and you just couldn't believe that one human being would be so sadistic as to treat other human beings that way. But it was very horrible.
Having experienced the brutality of war, service members dreamed about returning home. But when that time finally came, many discovered that things had changed in their absence.
It was just an ideal place. And so when I thought of home, that's what I thought of, going back to that. And when I got back home, my mother had moved. She'd moved to Massachusetts Avenue. It was a place where once upon a time, people had mansion-like houses, which my mother had bought one of those for a lodging house. She'd gone into that business. Well, you can imagine how I felt expecting or picturing myself with my mother and sister on Symphony Road and then finding them on Mass Avenue in a house full of strange people, strange to me. And I felt somehow that they were interfering with our domestic tranquility. And so it was a shock. It was really a shock. And my sister had grown up too fast in many ways. She wasn't my baby sister anymore. Oh, so many things. But that happens in war. So I was disappointed. And the joy I thought I would have upon arriving home was somewhat subdued, wilted, but I adjusted to that.
The Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, better known as the GI Bill, was designed to help veterans returning from war find their place back in society. It provided funds for education, for unemployment insurance, and for buying homes and starting businesses. These benefits enabled millions of service members to join the middle class and move to the suburbs, and fueled post-war economic prosperity in the U.S.
The alliance between the Soviet Union and the United States, which was strengthened during World War II, broke down soon after the war's end. Conflicting political ideologies and desire for global influence pitted the two countries against each other. The period of military and political rivalry between the two superpowers, known as the Cold War, resulted in a number of proxy wars, especially in Asia. The Korean War was the first major military confrontation of the Cold War. The United States' involvement in the Korean War was driven by a fear of the spread of communism in Asia. The war began in the summer of 1950 when North Korean communist forces attacked the U.S.-supported South Korean forces. It did not result in a clear victory for either side, and was negotiated to an end in 1953. The war left Korea divided, as it remains to this day. About a decade later, the United States began sending forces to Vietnam, where a similar situation was developing between a communist North and a U.S.-backed South. As the war progressed, opinion about the American involvement in Vietnam became increasingly divided.
The morality of the war? Mm-hmm. No, there wasn't any. Obviously, Ho Chi Minh was a communist. He wasn't perfect. But 80% of the people in Vietnam wanted him to be their leader. That should have been their choice. Obviously, we couldn't let that happen because he was a communist and we were afraid that he was tied up in some kind of horrible worldwide communist conspiracy. Ho Chi Minh was a nationalist. Frankly, as far as I'm concerned, he was the George Washington of his country. But that didn't matter to us. We were going to impose, and we did impose, our own leadership. We supported a succession of puppet dictators, got into a situation from which we could not extricate ourselves, or refused to.
In August 1964, following reports of two alleged attacks by North Vietnamese torpedo boats on the American destroyer Maddox in the Gulf of Tonkin, President Lyndon B. Johnson sought approval from Congress for military action against North Vietnam. Later investigations contradicted the official government account that the North Vietnamese attacks were unprovoked, and also proved that the second alleged attack did not even take place. However, at the time, the public strongly supported President Johnson's decision to escalate military involvement in Vietnam. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, approved by Congress on August 7, 1964, authorized the United States' open entry into the war.
After the Tonkin Gulf stuff happened, at the time, nobody really knew what was going on, and we weren't sure, and the official line was our ships had been attacked, and I didn't know anything any different, but I did know what the ships were doing. I didn't know what those patrols were about. But the feeling on the ship was, we were attacked by the evil Vietnamese, let's go get them. You know, everybody was kind of like gung-ho. And a few days after all of that activity, the Maddox, the first ship that had been attacked, was scheduled to be refueled by us. So I was out there visible in open space, timing the operation, and the Maddox is hooked up alongside of us. And while I'm standing there timing the operation, I hear these guys calling my name from the Maddox. I looked over there, and these are guys from Taiwan, from the Naval Security Group. That's when I realized, ultimately, what the ship was there for, what they were doing there, why the Vietnamese would have even attacked them, because the idea was to provoke some kind of response. But at that time, the Vietnamese were getting attacked by other forces that we were supporting, and so they thought the ship was part of that other attack. So once I realized what the Maddox had been doing there and who was on the ship and what they were involved in, then I laid that up next to what the president was telling the American public they were there for, and the fact that they were not in international waters, they were actually in Vietnamese waters. That was all I needed to hear.
In 1965, the first ground troops were deployed in Vietnam, and many more Americans were drafted into the military. Feelings about the draft were conflicted and complicated. Some supported or accepted the draft, but it was also a lightning rod for the anti-war movement.
My initial reaction, well, I wasn't particularly enthused about going into the Army because it seemed to involve physical labor in boot camp and things of that nature. Looking back on it, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me because had I not been drafted, I'm sure I'd have spent those 2 years just shooting pool somewhere and just getting 2 years older. It was a shock. Like many people from small towns, I never met anyone from areas other than small towns. I'd probably not been outside of central Illinois other than for a vacation in my entire life. And then when I got into the Army, I met people from strange places like California and New York that I'd only barely heard of. And they spoke with strange accents. It was enlightening and it was certainly eye-opening.
Many women and minorities served in the Army during the Vietnam War. Between 7 and 11,000 women served in Vietnam, almost 90% as military nurses. Others served as doctors and intelligence officers, or in administration or communications. Additionally, many civilian women worked for the Red Cross and other humanitarian organizations, and some were journalists. By the time of the Vietnam War, the military was racially integrated. President Harry Truman had signed Executive Order 9981 in July of 1948, forbidding racial discrimination against military personnel and officially desegregating the armed forces. The law established equality of treatment and opportunity, but was only fully implemented after the Korean War. However, subtle forms of discrimination persisted. The shared experiences of discrimination often created strong bonds of racial pride and solidarity among minorities.
When you go in, they have guys that parents were in the Ku Klux Klan and black guys that were been in gangs for generations, and they break that cycle right away. They tell you, you are green. You are no longer black, brown, white, or yellow. You are green. You're in the green machine. And so, no, they didn't put up with that nonsense. I didn't see too much of it. There was some, but not a lot. And the thing about Vietnam was that blacks were very, very close there in Vietnam. We would salute each other with a black power sign whenever we saw each other. And we wore braided shoelaces on our wrists. That became popular later in the United States, but it was to show unity. And so we had black symbols and black jewelry that we made with beads and things and Vietnamese coins.
On January 31st, 1968, the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong launched the Tet Offensive, a series of coordinated surprise attacks on South Vietnamese and U.S. forces across 100 South Vietnamese towns and cities. It was the largest military campaign of the Vietnam War. The attack caught the South Vietnamese and U.S. forces off guard because it took place during the Vietnamese holiday of Tet, or the Lunar New Year, when both sides had agreed to a two-day ceasefire. The South Vietnamese and U.S. eventually repelled the North Vietnamese forces, but both sides suffered heavy casualties. The ferocity and scale of the attacks shocked the U.S. government and the public. The event marked a turning point in the war as President Johnson began scaling back U.S. involvement.
One night, we were camped outside of a town. I can't remember the name of it now. But it was a fairly large population center. And we noticed that the rockets, it was just like 4th of July. But it wasn't fireworks. It was rockets going just one after another from all around us. They were going into this town and just exploding all over the place. We found out the next morning that that was the beginning of what they call the Tet Offensive, and that was the North Vietnamese, the regular army North Vietnamese, were invading these areas here, and they were trying to occupy a certain space for a certain amount of time, and they were trying to get as much publicity as possible. The Tet Offensive went on for many days in certain parts of the country, and I believe that made a big difference in the war as far as the United States was concerned, because that changed the tide. That awakened a lot of people to the idea that we didn't really belong there.
While the North Vietnamese were driven back and sustained heavy casualties during the Tet Offensive, media coverage of the attack eroded the public's support of the war. News of the Tet Offensive shocked the public, which was now aware that many Vietnamese civilians had become casualties in a seemingly endless war. For American soldiers fighting in Vietnam, interactions with Vietnamese civilians were shaped by their role as an occupying force. Their experiences ranged from positive to frightening.
The majority of Vietnamese indigenous people with whom they dealt were frankly the bartenders, the prostitutes, and the drug dealers. And these people, for reasons that should not be difficult to discern, just fell all over themselves telling the GIs how much they loved them and how proud they were and how happy they were to have American soldiers over there fighting to keep them free from Ho Chi Minh. Well, no matter how smart these American soldiers were, apparently it never dawned on them that the Vietnamese were being nice to them because they were paying them to be nice to them. When we got out in the field, we had rather limited contact with Vietnamese civilians, which was all for the better because one didn't know if they were simply ladies wanting to do your laundry or ladies wanting to blow you up who were in fact part of the Viet Cong. But when we would go on armored convoys through villages in Vietnam, we would see lined up along the sides of the road dozens and dozens of Vietnamese civilians, usually old men, women, and children. And not being a mind reader and not being a psychiatrist, I can pretty well guarantee you they weren't happy to see us there, and they weren't ready to tell us how much they loved us, because they didn't, and they weren't.
During the war, communication between soldiers and their families, usually via letters, was slow and unreliable, so families back home had to depend on TV and radio broadcasts for information about what was going on in Vietnam. As a result, both service members and their families felt anxious and disconnected. Eventually, service people returned home and were reunited with their families. But unlike soldiers returning from previous wars, Vietnam veterans were greeted by a less than welcoming public that was tired of the long war. Some anti-war protesters expressed hostility towards the returning soldiers. These reactions, along with the trauma of warfare, made readjustment to civilian life more difficult for veterans.
Suffering, they were coming back addicted to drugs, they were coming back with mental illnesses and having a tough time adjusting, and alcoholism was prevalent, and there weren't a lot of assistance for those guys. The Veterans Administration, the VA hospitals were full, and there was long waiting lines to get service. It just, there wasn't a lot for veterans. Veterans weren't taken care of very well after Vietnam. And the general public's opinion about the war had changed. They'd gotten kind of bitter about the war. And there was an element in the public that would call veterans baby killers and a bunch of terrible things. And there wasn't a time to be proud of serving your country. I actually came home in civilian clothes when I was finally discharged, and I didn't want to wear my uniform. I let my hair grow a little bit. I didn't want people to know that I was a soldier traveling home. And so I kind of kept a low profile. Even after I got home, I was looking for work, and I had grown so big over those couple of years that I couldn't wear any of my old clothes. The only coat I had was a military jacket, and I wore that jacket, and people would ask me about the war or the military, and I wouldn't give them too much information about it because there was a lot of negative stuff directed towards soldiers at that time.
I had guys that came back, and you've heard stories of people being spit on. At least two of my men had that happen to them. They were in uniform. They got spit on. They got abused. They got cussed out. More than two of them had to happen, but two of them were literally spit on by people. My fathers came home, and my uncles came home, and the men came home from World War II, and they were heroes. They were all heroes, and the nation was grateful and honored them. These guys come home, and maybe they're week or 2 weeks out of diving in a rice paddy and in the mud and the blood and getting shot at, and they get off a plane in San Francisco, and here's some butthead that comes up and insults them, calls them names, and denigrates what they've done when they're proud to be wearing that uniform. And then they're told in some areas, do not wear your uniform. It's too dangerous to wear your uniform. And they became victims of our own society that they had sworn to protect and truly risked their lives to do so.
During the 1960s and 70s, the counterculture movement was growing and the Vietnam War became a focus for protesters. Anti-war protests and demonstrations were held at many colleges and universities, including the University of Illinois.
Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't a merchant anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. It's always the young to fight. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?
I came to the University of Illinois to work in July of 1970. There were some demonstrations going on. I have this memory of the rocks around Altguild Hall being sprayed with something to glue them down so that the demonstrators could not pick those rocks up and throw them at each other or at windows of buildings, etc. Quite honestly, coming from a small town, it was really an eye-opener to actually see in person the demonstrations against the war.
Some returning Vietnam veterans also opposed the war, and many joined the anti-war organization Vietnam Veterans Against the War after returning to the United States.
My guess is this was the first time in United States history that large numbers of veterans returning from a war said, no, this is wrong. I mean, you're going to have pacifists and people in any war who say, no, this is wrong, and, you know, God love them. But this was the first time in our history that thousands of veterans came back and said, hey, this is wrong. There was something called Operation Dewey Canyon 3 about 40 years ago, where large numbers of combat veterans stood up in front of the White House and denounced the war and took their medals and threw them at the White House, which was a big symbolic thing. I mean, medals are supposed to be really important to veterans, and to some extent they are. But here were these veterans saying, hey, we don't want your medals, Mr. Nixon, because we're not proud of what we had to do and where we had to go to get them. I don't know that Vietnam Veterans Against the War has really gotten its due credit in American history.
To help ease the transition to civilian life, Vietnam veterans were eligible for a broad range of programs and services provided by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, or the VA. Benefits included education funds, home and business loans, and health care. Additionally, colleges across the country began providing special programs for veterans.
In 1973 or 1974, William Proxmire from the state of Wisconsin came up with a bill that he thought veterans should be paid a lot more. And so because of him, we got a raise, and which was really nice. And not only that, if you were married and had children, you got extra money. So that really made a big difference for me. And that was because of the veterans organization there. They provided us with a lot of help. We had tutoring, and when it came time to register for classes, we were given priority, which made a difference because some of the classes were really hard to get into. If you were a veteran, you didn't have any trouble getting into them. When it came time to get your check every month, they had your check ready for you. That made a difference.
In 1975, the Vietnam War ended when Saigon, the capital of South Vietnam, fell to the North Vietnamese. By this time, the United States had withdrawn its troops from the region and had suspended the draft. Soldiers no longer fought overseas, but did serve on U.S. military bases across the world and at home. Military strength and preparedness remained crucial to the U.S. due to the ongoing Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union.
The Cold War came to an end in the 1980s when the Russian economy collapsed due to heavy military spending and economic crises within the country. The U.S. Armed Forces also underwent major transformations around this time.
And the 80s was the new army. It was a volunteer army. The draft wasn't in place anymore. People wanted to be there. So it's unlike at a time maybe in the 60s and 70s when there was always the term, go to war, go to jail, you know. So a lot of people didn't want to be there when they were drafted. But when in the 80s, when I went in, it was the new army. And you could no longer really, drill sergeants couldn't degrade a soldier like they did before.
This new army offered a career path and a future for many men and women from Illinois.
So a recruiter, it just sort of seemed to solve all the problems at once. College was paid for, getting out of town, education and training, meals are provided, plus money, you got a job, you're legitimate in society. Everything fell into place, sort of.
My brother and my nephew that joined the National Guard, for them it was a way to better their life and to provide for their families. So that was their motivation. And of course, they weren't drafted the way my Uncle Tom was drafted in the era of Vietnam. And even my boys, they signed. They went in. It's your free choice now, as opposed to years ago when you were drafted, whether you wanted to go or not. So I think the motivation, at least for my nephew and for my brother, it was they'd graduated high school, they were looking for a way to better themselves and to provide for their families, and so the military was a way for them to do that.
Jessica was just a normal Midwestern girl that had gotten involved in the military, and I think there's a lot of those. There's a lot of people that get in the military for the money, and that way I think that it is kind of slanted. If you have money, you're probably not going to join the military, or unless you join at a higher level, an officer and those kind of things.
The end of the Cold War did not bring about global peace, as some had hoped. In 1990, Iraq, led by Saddam Hussein, invaded Kuwait, a move which also endangered Kuwait's oil-rich neighbor, Saudi Arabia. In response, on January 17, 1991, the United States launched Operation Desert Storm, during which U.S.-led multinational forces drove Iraqi forces out of Kuwait and invaded Iraq. This conflict was known as the Gulf War. On March 1, 1991, a ceasefire was negotiated, and Iraq agreed to destroy its nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons programs. The United States' presence in Saudi Arabia during and after the Gulf War fueled anti-American sentiments among militant Islamic groups like Al-Qaeda, which was led by Osama bin Laden. A decade later, on September 11, 2001, several militants associated with Al-Qaeda hijacked four planes and used them in suicide attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. 2,977 people were killed, and many others were injured.
People were shocked. People were very angry. A lot of people knew right away who Osama bin Laden was because we were able to find out do research and things like that. I mean, this was, you know, 2001, not everybody had the internet, but at work we had the internet, so we could these things up and do that kind of stuff. So people were angry at Bin Laden, of course. And a lot of people volunteered, wanted to go. When we go back to Afghanistan, I want to go. I want to be there. And we had a small office that was getting Marines together to send over to Afghanistan.
I remember a feeling of disbelief when it happened. It was almost like it wasn't real, but I knew it was real. And even though it was, you know, happening outside of where I physically was, there was this feeling of, I didn't feel separated. I felt like in my community at that moment, it didn't matter where we were in America, people were kind of being more patient and compassionate with each other. So it was almost like we're watching this really fast movie and all of a sudden we hit pause and we all just kind of stop. And now we're trying to check in and gather our senses. That's how I felt. And I also felt intuitively, I think, that I knew that those circumstances were going to somehow lead to war, and somehow in what capacity I wasn't sure, but I knew that I would be involved in it.
9/11 for a lot of people's children was the first major tragedy that they had ever experienced in relation to, you know, their country. I grew up with Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy all getting assassinated within 6 months of each other, November to May or something like that. In a relatively short time frame, we lost three very prominent people in this country, and our children never had anything like that until 9/11. And then that attack was on our own soil in one of the biggest cities in our nation. I have no doubt that that influenced a great many of the young men and women who subsequently joined the military.
In response to the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 to destroy al-Qaeda and capture its leader, Osama bin Laden. As a continuation of what President George W. Bush called the War on Terror, the United States invaded Iraq in 2003. The U.S. overthrew Saddam Hussein, believing he possessed weapons of mass destruction and was sympathetic to terrorist groups. The United States' interventions in both Afghanistan and Iraq evoked strong reactions among Arab and Islamic nations.
When we invaded Iraq, it upset a lot of our Arab allies. There was a lot of protests in Bahrain. They would hold candlelight vigils asking us to stop, and it was very all peaceful, and the, you know, United Arab Emirates always let us fly over their country through Pakistan to Afghanistan. They agreed with that. But once we invaded Iraq, they were politically opposed to that. They said that we were no longer welcome to fly over. That meant that we had to go through the Straits of Hormuz. And the Persian Gulf was very congested in the first place. Iran, of course, they feel threatened. So as the Persian linguist, I was supposed to try and listen if there was any kind of hostility happening. It was just tense. People would ask us, who are you? What are you doing? I never spoke on the radio because that's only officers do that. But we would always give the most, what I call, arrogant and obtuse answer. So we'd say, we are a U.S. plane conducting a signal security flight in accordance with all recognized international laws. Imagine saying that to your principal. I'm obeying all the recognized school laws, so just don't bother me.
One of the things he said that I'll never forget, he said, you could drive through some villages and you'd see the children, and you'd see some of them that were so happy to see you, to see the U.S. military. And other villages you'd go through, and he says there was these little kids and there was already hatred in their eyes. They were just already, even at that very young age, they'd been told they're bad people. I thought, that's a sad thing. That has to be a terribly sad thing to see.
In the United States, public opinion about U.S. involvement in recent wars varies significantly.
The number of people who have personal interaction with people in the armed forces and veterans is a fraction of what it was. I would say probably most people don't know somebody that's currently serving in the military, or even somebody that has. But I think today, you go back to Vietnam, we had no internet, no satellite television. We had three television networks. Any of the news that we got came from the front, came back. You know, film was developed, was aired. Everything was time delay. Today, you can watch the riots in Syria and Cairo real time. You can watch them on Skype. So I think people are much more aware of what's going on in the world today, or at least superficially they're aware. They can be aware if they want.
I think they're out of touch with it. I don't think they want to deal with the fact that people in Afghanistan have families. They scream when they're hurt. They're just like us. People, I don't think that they really think about that. I think that they don't want to believe that, and I think that they think that the U.S. has a magic wand that it can drop bombs and people will start holding elections. It's just not the way it works.
Since World War II, the United States military has evolved constantly, changing its policies regarding race, gender, and sexual orientation. The integration of women into the military, for example, has taken decades, and the ban on women in combat was only lifted in January of 2013. Yet even now, women face unique challenges.
The women were in their own barracks room, but the barracks floor was co-ed. We work together, everyone works together. Like I said, every race and every gender works together pretty seamlessly if it's a good unit. But, I mean, women would hang out with women and women hang out with men. There wasn't a lot of, we got to stick together, ladies, at that time. There was a slight competitiveness to make sure that no one was going to be lazy, because if there was one lazy woman, we would all get painted with the same brush. So there was an idea that we all have to try extra hard and continue to prove ourselves.
You're going to find nationally that women veterans are more likely to have a higher incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder. There's also a false assumption that because women cannot serve directly in combat, in the infantry and things like that, there's an assumption that they're shielded from the violence, but we're finding that that's not the case. We have women who are flying helicopters, who are driving trucks that get ambushed or that hit IEDs, and so there's a lot of trauma that women are exposed to, just like male soldiers. There's also a fairly high rate of what's called military sexual trauma. The military has always traditionally been a very masculine institution, and to be a woman in a traditionally masculine institution has a whole set of challenges and barriers. My experience is that it really comes down to your unit's leadership, that if you have strong leadership in a unit, they're not going to stand for that kind of conduct.
I was a female in charge of all 18 of these males. We worked a lot with the local population. That is an Arabic culture, and females don't rank very high on the societal structure in an Arabic culture. So I'm in charge of all these guys, but the locals don't want to talk to me because I'm a female. And in their culture, it's rude for me to initiate any sort of contact with them. So finding a way to overcome that so we could still accomplish our mission while still trying to be respectful of their cultural beliefs was a bit challenging.
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people have also faced and continue to face unique challenges in the military. In 1993, the United States adopted the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which prevented openly LGBT people from serving in the military. This policy was discontinued in 2011.
It was very lonely sometimes. When you did find the other gay person, you prayed to God, oh my God, now we're hanging out together. Is everyone going to think that we're gay together? You know, yes, we are, but even if you're just looking for friendship and not romance, it's hard. It's a hard thing. And then if they're a woman that, quote, looked gay, like had these archetypes that society assumed to be lesbian archetypes and how they dressed or how they wore their hair, there was a worry that, oh man, if I hang out with you, am I also going to get brushed with the gay brush? Am I also going to be found out? So there is this never-ending, tiresome idea that at any minute, anybody who didn't like you could rat you out and could set the Navy Investigative Services, I'm forgetting the acronym, could set those people after you. They can follow you and do anything they want just to catch you in the act. It's not like you would be doing something, you know, having sex in a storeroom. They could follow you to your home and see how long you hang out with another person, see if you two went to a movie together. They were allowed to do that and then write up and say that you're gay. It wasn't even a catching in the act thing. It was an actual hunting up. It was sickening. That was difficult. That was really difficult.
Gay oppression is one of the biggest symptoms of masculinity and male oppression. I wish I could say what will happen. This is going to be a pretty prickly transition, I'm sure. Things were starting to change while I was in, but in general, it's a hostile environment. I'm optimistic. I think they can change. Some branches and certain pockets of the military will change faster than others, but it's a good thing. Nobody liked it when they let women in. They complained and they raised hell when they integrated the troops between black and white soldiers. The transition will be painful. A lot of people will dislike it. My grandfather, he didn't even like the fact that there was African-American troops after World War II. Prejudice, racism, homophobia dies slowly. And that's sad, but at least it's a slow march for progress.
Differences in the religious backgrounds of service members can also pose challenges. During the recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, Muslims have sometimes experienced difficulties while serving in the U.S. Armed Services.
There were a lot of people that literally would walk up to me and say, so I heard you're Arab. And I'm like, no, actually, I'm Afghan. That's different. oh, okay, whatever. So you're Muslim? And I'm like, yeah, I don't drink. And they're like, God, it's crazy. You don't drink. They would get in this weird apology circle where they are apologizing for drinking. Like, I care if someone drinks. I don't care if someone drinks. And then they would invariably start going on and say, well, you know what? Sometimes all that stuff that happens in the Middle East, again, not realizing Afghanistan is not in the Middle East. I just think if you just drop a bomb on it, just make it a big glass crater. And it took me like a satellite link pause to like connect the dots that, oh yeah, when you melt sand, it turns to glass. Got it. And I would just stare at this person like, are you serious? You just want to drop a bomb on, oh yeah, I think that'll just solve our problems. I was like, good Lord.
U.S. military service impacts not just service people, but entire families, especially in wartime.
You have a loved one that's going off to war. I don't think I'll ever forget the feeling of seeing him walk towards that plane, not know whether he'd come home okay or not. It was very frightening. And even though during the time he was gone, we had distractions for periods of time, like my husband said just last night, he said that still, it just sits there. It's never fully gone. I had a lot of anxiety during the time he was gone. Anything could happen. So we just constantly were praying that nothing happened and thankful when the phone rang and it was him checking in. I had to make myself not watch the news, not read the internet, because the more I got into that, the greater my fear. It would almost like grow exponentially. It would just get out of control. I trained myself not to do all that. We only had one cell phone, and when he was deployed, my husband went and got another cell phone. We added call forward to our phone. I told my boss that if we were in a meeting and the phone rang, I would excuse myself, but that during this time I really needed to take any calls in case it was him. I was fortunate enough to have a very understanding boss during that time.
For those who remain at home, their days are full of anxiety and uncertainty. Sometimes, war has an irreversible effect on a family.
We just felt like God was just so taking care of Jessica. We did realize it was a war and that it was not safe. We just felt like Jessica was certainly in God's hands. Actually, it would have been October 7th, and it was a Thursday morning, and my husband works for Aramark Uniform, and he gets up and goes early. And so he had already left, and for some reason, I just didn't go right back to sleep. The doorbell rang, and my first thought was, uh-oh, why is the doorbell ringing at this time? And then I remembered that my son Joshua had a friend, Marty, that had just done that to me previously. I don't think it was exactly the day before, and had scared me on that motive, too. And I had given him a tongue lash, and I said, Marty, do not do that. Do not ring the doorbell. You come right on in. And so I was thinking, here it is. Marty's ringing the door again. And I just had on my nightgown, and I could see we had a bi-level, and so I could see through the door. We had a window in there, and I saw the military. I immediately thought, well, Jessica's probably dead, but I kind of creeped down, and I answered, and they said, can we talk to you and your husband? And I was like, no, my husband's not home, and they honestly were a little rude about that. They're like, what? Your husband's not home? And I was like, well, he's already gone to work, and they're like, well, we need him here. And I was like, just tell me, is Jessica dead? And they really would not. I really had a teeny, tiny, tiny bitty hope that maybe she had just been injured badly, and I had not really heard of this before, if she was injured bad enough that they had to come to your door to tell you. Just a little shimmer of hope that maybe that was it, and maybe that's why they weren't telling me. But anyway, I invited them in and attempted to get hold of my husband. So anyway, this whole process really lasted a good half hour to 45 minutes. Again, I was just like, you know, I'm not going to call my husband if she's alive. And so finally, they did actually, because they could see that the longer they kept delaying it, that the worse it was getting. It's really sad for them that this is what they have to do, but I'm sure this is what they're guided to do. It was a male and a female, and they just said this specific thing that, you know, we're sorry to tell you that your daughter's dead, but they said it in a nice military fashion way. So then when I finally got hold of my husband, then he called and I couldn't even talk at all. And he's like, is somebody there? And I'm like, yeah. And he says, is it the military? And he's like, yeah. He says, Jessica dead? And I was like, yeah.
The military provides support services for the families of service members killed in action. But in the end, families find their own ways of coping with the loss.
People wanted to interview us. There were memorial services to go to. The most difficult thing that we did entirely was going to when the soldiers came home, because Jessica didn't come with them. And that was really hard. But but we felt it was very important for us to be there to show that we did not blame them. They all felt, not all, many of them, and many of them still do, feel guilty that she died. They feel like they should have died instead, or, you know, those kinds of things. And we felt like we needed to support them. And so that was one of the most difficult things we did have to do.
For returning soldiers, the challenges of readjusting to civilian life are many. But the transition can be made easier through the support of the public.
One thing that's good now is that we have learned to respect our service people. The men and women who serve their country are now honored, as they should be. And I see the young people in our society holding that up to be honored. That's very gratifying. You can't imagine what that means to somebody like me to see that our society, especially our young people, do honor those who have served. Whether they agree with what the country has them doing or not, they don't denigrate the service of the people who are there.
When I first went in, it was just post-Vietnam conflict. And it was a lot of bad feelings out there. And I don't feel like I was ever treated poorly or anything. And I think I was treated pretty well throughout the years. As I walk through airports myself and I see how people treat soldiers, it's incredible. I mean, the response to soldiers now, I think, is really incredible. And because of Iraq and Afghanistan, I think that for the most part, I think the views of a soldier are just the responses I see. I was once at an airport, I was just talking with a lady, and she said, "Oh, excuse me." And then she said, "Hey, soldier, thank you for your service," you know, and that type of thing happens all the time. I see somebody, "Hey, can I get your bill at the restaurant," or something like that, you know, and I've done it myself to help soldiers out. I think the response is really good.
To assist returning service personnel, President George W. Bush signed the post-9/11 GI Bill into law. The bill provides comprehensive financial support for education, counseling, and housing benefits for veterans.
Well, in the state of Illinois, you have what's called a National Guard grant, which pays your full tuition. It doesn't pay any of the fees, but it pays your full tuition, which is very nice. And then they have something called a GI Bill. A GI Bill is the federal government's way of paying for your education. So in addition to getting a grant from the state of Illinois for being in the National Guard, paying for my tuition, I also have the federal government offering me benefits to help pay for school as well. So thankfully, I haven't had to pay much in terms of my education because of my service.
Service-related injury or illness can add to the difficulty of reintegration. Some veterans are physically wounded. Others may suffer from less obvious psychological injuries, such as post-traumatic stress disorder.
When I worked at the VA, sometimes I would meet with a veteran and I would say, "How long have you been back?" 18 months. "Okay. Why did you wait 18 months? Did anything happen?" "Well, I just got my third DUI. You know, or my wife just left me. Or I just punched through a car window and cut up my hand." What I was seeing is that there was a lot of trauma and unfortunate events that took place. And then now they're going into getting the help that they need. So I really think it's important to address that before these types of issues build up. I would like to see a resort similar to something that you would find in Cancun and make it mandatory that all returning service members who come home would have to spend at least 30 days getting massages, going through counseling, doing yoga, coming down from whatever experience they had before we release them from active duty, and even before we release them to their families. But I think that where I'm seeing the disconnect is that when they come home, and when I came home even, it's such a fast process and you're so tired. It takes many, many months later on before you start to kind of start dealing with certain things.
Veteran support services on college campuses all around the country have been improving and developing in order to make the transition to civilian life easier.
I think that one assumption that comes out sometimes is that when we think about Iraq and Afghanistan or any war, it can be easy to immediately focus on the negative, like, and I'm not trying to minimize at all things like post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, but I think sometimes when we hear Iraq and Afghanistan, my colleagues would think, "Oh, well, you know, I wonder if this person is okay or if they have problems." And so immediately there can be an assumption that they've had this very traumatic, horrific experience. And I think that's important, but I think that we also want to make them aware of all the good things that veterans bring, that they contribute to the diversity of the campus, that they have a lot of life experience, and, you know, they've done some pretty amazing things at a young age. How do we kind of build off these strengths rather than just focusing on these deficits?
Throughout the 20th and 21st centuries, the military has affected the lives of numerous people from Central Illinois, including those featured in this program. They have each had a unique experience, filling a variety of roles in the military and on the home front. Despite the hardships that come with military service and with supporting those who serve, most of these men and women feel that they've gained something worthwhile through their involvement with the armed forces. They have changed the military, and the military has changed them.
I would say that the military gave me a slice and an experience of life that a lot of my peers haven't had necessarily. And so I do feel that it's given me wisdom in the sense of being able to travel, being able to serve in a war zone, being able to work in a lot of just interesting places, interesting climates, to interact with interesting cultures. So I do feel that there have been some tremendous experiences that have come out of that. You know, I'd like to think that in time, hopefully that will translate into wisdom.
I just want to say my experience was positive. I think women and gays still have a long fight ahead of them, certainly within the structure of the military and certainly when they're veterans and in the civilian world, because they're always going to have to fight for their benefits. But when I think about the military experience, it's always the good, the bad, and the ugly. I still think about it as a positive thing. It was a lot of hard work, some of the hardest I've ever worked, but it was good, and it was rewarding, and I learned a great deal. And it's enriched my life now as a student because I apply a lot of those same work ethics to my academics and to my art and how I organize my life. But it really was an adventure. The Navy slogan when they're recruiting is, you know, live the adventure, or it's not just a job, it's an adventure. I can't believe I'm saying that, but it really was. I got to travel all over the world. I got to see things. I got bit by a lion. I had a helicopter land on me. There was a lot of crazy things that happened that were fun and potentially life-ending, but I look back at it as being, like, adventurous. I've led an adventurous life. I've got to see things I never would have seen. I got to fly over the Persian Gulf, and it's absolutely gorgeous. It was lovely. Fly over a volcano? I mean, who gets to do that all the time? So it was a lot of fun. I met a lot of different people and got to do a lot of different things.
We hope you enjoyed From the Front Lines to the Home Front, Inside Views of the Military 1940 to 2012. This program was produced by University Laboratory High School students Sanjay Koshi and Leif Haig.
Student editors included Issy Michael, Mary Campbell, Evan Dankovich, Mara Dolan, Simone Gaworth, Alice Hu, Anna Canfer, Vinay Koshi, Michelle Liu, Emma Andrejkova, Lara Orlandic, Monica Pardeshi, Sherry Q, Ellen Rispoli, Marina Shaw, Nafisa Syed, Yuliana Taritsa, and Jonathan Yaki.
Interviews were conducted by students from the Uni High classes of 2015 and 2016.
Stories were contributed by Richard Atkins, Steve Allen, Charles Bruns, Sandy Carvey, Jacob Crawford, Chad Garland, Terry Harrell, Andy Hamblin, Jill Knappenberger, Joseph Miller, Nicholas Osborne, Joseph Rank, Karen Semple, Shaheen Shorish, Melody Simeone, Joseph Smith, Paul Wisavati, and Jerry Young. This program was directed by Dave Dickey of Illinois Public Media and University Laboratory High School teacher Janet Morford. For more information on this project, visit our website at illinoisyouthmedia.org. I'm Leif Haig.
And I'm Sanjay Koshi.